This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 36 was recorded October 20th, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. Robin Griffiths will be joining me as this week's featured interview guest. Robin and I will discuss his work with cycles, ranging from short-term seasonality cycles all the way up to the 39-year generational cycle. We'll then examine today's macro issues, ranging from the dollar to equities to treasury yields and gold, using Robin's work with cycles as a framework for our discussion.
And I'm Aaron Chen. The S&P 500 has recovered slightly from last week's lows, but only slightly. E-mini S&P futures traded as high as 2144 this week and closed Thursday session at 2135. So, Eric, any change for your equity outlook?
Not a whole lot of change. I think for the most part, the market is waiting for the election to be over. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a rally just because the uncertainty is eliminated after the election. And I wouldn't be surprised if that kind of made a final high and it was downhill from there, because I do think that we're headed towards recession territory. If you look at the market from a technical standpoint, the trend line that has been in play all the way since the 11th of February was one of the lows. The next low is the 24th of June. You draw the line between those two points, and you'll see that we've now actually begun to trade not so much below the line, but to the right side of the line. And that means that technically that uptrend line has been violated, but it hasn't been violated with a massive move to the downside. It's just a horizontal consolidation pattern for now. Most of the technicians that I'm reading have been saying that a close below 21.25 would be extremely bearish, because that would suggest that a downward move is in play next. So far, we haven't seen that. We've seen a horizontal consolidation. This morning, Thursday morning, we got within about a point of that just as I was recording the interview with Robin Griffiths. But as you said, by the close, we're looking at 21.37 back up safely above the line. Watch for that move below 21.25, and I wouldn't be surprised if we actually see a move higher after the election and then eventually move much lower. But again, it remains to be seen. So far, we could still be in buy the dip territory.
Okay. Now, before we move on to crude oil, let's start with the U.S. dollar index. Now, the DXY made an important upside breakout last week with a daily close above 97.50. Now, you said last week it needed to stay above 97.50 for at least a few days for confirmation, and lo and behold, it has. So, Eric, is it time to declare that the dollar rally has resumed in earnest?
Well, resumed, yes. Earnest, I'm not so sure about. Let's talk about the anatomy of an upside breakout. What happens is a market moves above some technical resistance level that previously acted as key resistance. In the case of the dollar index, that would be 97.50. Hasn't moved above that number since February. Sure enough, it did last week. And very much consistent with what tends to happen. You'll get an initial breakout, then everybody looks at it and says, oh boy, is this real or is it a false breakout? And the market drifts back down to retest that same key resistance level. But now the question is, has it become a support level? Sure enough, that's what happened last week. We went back down and just kissed 97.50, started moving up. Now, from there, it looked pretty good. But what would you would expect in a true upside breakout is at that point, people see confirmation and it's everybody's piling in at once. They can't get in fast enough because the previous resistance level has turned into a support level. It's held and everybody is just diving into the trade. We're really not seeing that here. What we're seeing is that, yeah, it just barely stayed above 97.50, kind of struggled its way along to stay above 97.50 for most of the last week. And then just after this morning's ECB meeting with Mario Draghi, we saw a bump all the way up to 98.40, then a retrace back down to 98.15, back up to 98.30 as we're recording on Thursday afternoon. So yeah, it's looking good, but it's not looking to me like a massive, huge move to the upside is upon us. We're just drifting higher, but we are now more than a week above that previous resistance level. So the next test is going to be the prior high, which I think on this cycle was more than a year ago now, a year and a half ago, I think. It was either 102 or 103. So the next test will be, can we get above that level? And do we eventually see some momentum building? Right now, it's been a little bit sluggish.
All right, well, moving on to crude oil. WTI reached new cycle highs this week, trading above $52 for the first time this year. So what's going on here, Eric?
Well, not only this year, I think that 52.22, which is the high print so far, that's the highest since July 2015. That's 15 months. So definitely very significant price level. What's going on? Huge inventory drawdown, 5.2 million barrel crude oil inventory draw this week against expectations of a build in inventory, because we're in, seasonally speaking, what should be a restocking period. Cushing, Oklahoma, 1.6 million barrel drawdown. Gasoline, 2.5 million barrel build on inventory, but distillates, 1.2 million barrel drawdown. So for the most part, drawdowns across the board. You talk about the world's biggest head fake. You know, what really confused Art Berman and I when we did the Labor Day weekend oil special is when we would normally not expect to see seasonal inventory builds occurring until late September into October, and we were seeing them in August, and it seemed like it was starting early. So when we saw those, we thought, boy, it was starting early. Just wait and see what September and October bring, and we've gone in totally the opposite direction. So when we should have been in the middle of summer driving season, in a drawdown period, we were building inventories. When we should be in a building period now, we're drawing down. So everything's working backwards. At the end of the day, though, this has gone on too long to write it off to some anomaly. Six of the last 7 weeks have been drawdowns on inventory. Cumulatively, that's 26 million barrels over the last 7 weeks that have been drawn down from national crude oil inventories. You know, it's time to say, hey, those of us who thought there was going to be a storage crisis just plain got it wrong. And sure, you could start seeing, you know, maybe there's some anomaly has to do with Hurricane Matthew delaying the arrival of some imports. Maybe they're going to come. But at this point, we've already drawn down enough inventory and we're far enough into the season. We're not going to have a storage crisis. So as I was saying last week, it felt like maybe these price levels, 51, 52 bucks, is kind of a high in terms of how far the market can go, based on the fact that if it goes much higher, we're just going to see a lot more shale drillers starting to add rigs. And of course, we did see an increase in production this week, which is a reflection of the increasing rig count. The thing is, to say it can't go much higher than here, can't go much higher than here if we're still working off this huge supply glut. If we're going to continue to see 5 million barrels a week of drawdowns, the price is going to eventually go much higher. So I've been thinking that we weren't there yet to the point where the market had rebalanced. Certainly a lot of other people, Goldman Sachs analysis has said that the market is still oversupplied, but boy, the inventory numbers sure don't reflect that. So if this continues, the prices could move substantially higher from here. I'm waiting to see what happens.
Gold has gained a little ground since we spoke last week, trading at about $1,266 on Thursday afternoon. So thankfully, Eric, I'm out of that broken record, but what's the update for the yellow metal?
Well, it actually got to 1275, almost 1276 earlier today. Post Mario Draghi, it kind of took a nosedive back down to 1266. But as you say, you know, a couple weeks ago, we were looking at a low print of 1243. Is it over? Did we miss the bottom? I haven't bought any gold yet. I've been waiting for lower prices. I still think that we're probably going to see a test of the low 1200s, you know, somewhere between 1200 and 1250. Maybe I'm wrong and we've missed it. I don't know. At this point, I have gone ahead and bought the dollar index, and I'm kind of waiting for gold to show a little bit more weakness before legging in to the other side of that long gold, long dollar trade that Raoul Paul and I have discussed on the program a couple weeks ago.
Got it. And finally, 10-year Treasury yields have been trading in the high 170s this week and closed Thursday afternoon around 175. So what's next from here?
You know, I really don't know. I think Raoul's got the right picture. We're in a bounce here in yields. Probably will eventually move lower in yields, but not until there's confirmation that a recession really is on the horizon, as I believe one is. You know, it's tempting to look for a bounce above 180 in yields and go long Treasury futures at that point. I'm not going to do it just because I think there's better trades. I'm much more optimistic about the gold trade playing out in the long run. I want to look for the right opportunity to get into a long position on gold. As far as this tactical long on Treasuries to maybe ride the yield down to 1% before reversing to a short, I'd rather wait it out.
Great. Thanks for the market update, Eric. Robin Griffiths is head of multi-asset research and advisory at the ECU Group. He was previously chief technical strategist at HSBC Investment Bank for 20 years before becoming head of global asset allocation at Rathbones, and then a director and technical strategist for Cazenove Capital Management. Robin was a partner of WI Carr and head of technical analysis at Grevis & Grant. Robin is a committee member and former chairman of the International Federation of Technical Analysts and former chairman, now fellow, of the British Society of Technical Analysts. Robin has been a member of ECU's global macro team for over 20 years. Eric's interview with Mr. Griffiths is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Robin Griffiths. And Robin, I normally start these macro interviews with the U.S. dollar, but I'd like to take a different approach with this one because I know that your approach to markets is very much based on cycles. So please explain your approach. Tell us about cycles and how you use them.
Well, I got into stockbroking 50 years ago, coming to it with a degree in economics. And in the economics, one of the more interesting bit was Joseph Schumpeter's work. He was Austrian, but he ended up as an American professor of economics. And he wrote a lot, very erudite books. And the bottom line is he didn't invent any single cycle. He simply said, these other people seem to have discovered different cycles in economic activity, people with names like Kondratiev and etc., Clements and their other names. And if they're right, the different cycles will interact with each other in a complicated way. And I'll show you how that happens. And what I did ever since I've been in the market is say, and if that is right, it will lead to a certain development in the stock market, and I'll draw you a map of what that looks like, where we've come from, and where we're going in the future. And the cycles, basically, in Schumpeter's model, is a very long-term cycle, which I simply call secular trends. But it was, he called it the Kondratiev way. Poor old Mr. Kondratiev got sent to Siberian Kulag, where he died, because the regime didn't like him telling them that they hadn't done anything clever, they were just riding an up cycle, and in due course it will turn down, which of course it did. And then the next cycle is a 10-year cycle, which is a, sort of like a long business cycle, and within it is a shorter-term business cycle. Which these days, of course, we call the presidential election cycle, because ever since the U.S. became the biggest economy, that your cycle is mandated to be 4 years. Whereas in the earlier period, when Great Britain was the dominant superpower, the cycle actually varied. It could have been as short as 3.5 years or even as long as 5. It simply had an average near to 4 years. And then there's an even shorter cycle, which is annual seasonality. Believe it or not, almost all financial markets have an annual seasonal deviation, and it's a northern hemisphere deviation because our northern economies dominate the rest of the planet. And, of course, you don't have to go back very far in time before agriculture was the most important thing, and, of course, naturally it has an annual seasonal cycle. So I simply put these things together. And then more recently, people have discovered other types of cycle. There's one called a geopolitical risk cycle. There's also a commodity market cycle, and et cetera, and the demographic cycle. Ever since we've heard about the baby boomers in America and the aging, shrinking population in Japan, people have realized that demographics is jolly important, and but waves of population do tend to go in cycles. Of course, none of these cycles are a sine wave. In Schumpeter's model, he drew them out as a diagram as though the cycles were equal and nice, neat sine waves and show how they would interact with each other. But in reality, it's much noisier and more varied than that. But nonetheless, these up and down movements in cyclical fashion do appear very regularly. And whilst you're in the up or the down part, you're in a very dominant trend. So having identified that trend, you can indeed back it. And some of these cyclical movements move for incredibly long periods of time. So, for example, in the Western world, we've actually been in a secular downtrend since the year 2000. And the fact that the S&P and the Dow are higher now than they were then doesn't override that fact. The secular trend in the Western world has been negative for 16 years. And the bad news is that isn't long enough to end the secular trend. It's going to carry on for quite a lot more years yet before the next secular uptrend kicks in.
Robin, I know that there is excellent basis in history for the work that you do with cycles that proves out their predictive value. But if I can play devil's advocate for a minute, I think a skeptic might say, hey, wait a minute, central bank intervention over the last 8 years has changed the game. And that means that really, you know, you could argue that whatever value cycles may have had in the past, the name of the game now is central bank intervention and monetary policy affecting markets. Does that throw these cycles off balance? They stop working, or am I missing something?
No, you're absolutely correct. In what Bill Gross has called the new normal, bank intervention, quantitative easing, zero interest rates, all of that, or negative interest rates, is completely unprecedented. And I go a long way along with you to suggest that what we used to call the capital asset pricing model, or capitalism, has been smashed to pieces as a matter of deliberate policy. Of course, they think, most of these governments, that they're following Lord Keynes's ideas faithfully. But Japan's been doing that longer than the rest of us, and it absolutely doesn't work. But what they've definitely done, the whole thing about capitalism is prices should be decided by the interreaction of willing buyer and willing seller. And if some businesses or product is meant to go down in price and go bust, you have to let it go bust, otherwise capitalism doesn't work. And what you've got at the moment is central banks delighted that things go up in price, but as soon as they look like they might want to come back down again, they step in and try to stop it. And of course, they've been successful up to a point. What we think is happening is central banks are collectively running out of bullets. The effect of each intervention. The intervention has to be bigger and bigger for less and less effect. It's rather like injecting a drug addict. He needs a bigger hit to get the same response. And it absolutely cannot go on much longer. So at some point, we're going to return to what Bill Gross would have called the old normal. And in the old normal, interest rates would normally be something like whatever rate the economy grew at plus a bit for inflation. So if the economy is growing at, say, 2.5% and you get about that much inflation, interest rates shouldn't be a long way different than 5%. But if you try and go to 5% from where we are now, you would cause such a massive destruction of wealth in the bond market globally, you would bring on something worse than the Great Depression of the 1930s, which is clearly not in anybody's interest. So what typically happens is when there are factors intervening in the cycles, it's much easier to override the shorter term cycles than the very long term ones. So, for example, the annual seasonality, you can easily stop that from happening. And even the shorter term 4-year cycle has been overridden to some extent. But what you can't do, no government's ever done, is to stop the demographic cycles and these longer-term ones. So when you've got a generation as big as America's post-World War II baby boom generation, as they grew up, they drove the entire economy before them. But no force on earth can stop them now being in their retirement part of their life cycle. And it doesn't matter when they die. They could all live to be 120. What matters for the economy point of view is the expenditure in their life cycle. And that tends to peak out round about the age of 50 to 53, that sort of thing, when they've got their biggest house, the kids living at home, they're paying the school fees and all that sort of thing. Now that all the baby boomers are clearly older than that, the kids have left and gone off on their own, and they're scaling down, they're looking for two things, a pension plan. Well, normally your pension plan would be quite a lot invested in the government bond market as a risk-free asset. Well, the intervention has meant there is not enough yield on that to fund the pension. So that's bad news, number one. And the second thing these older people look for is their health. And Mr. Obama and the Congress have gone and kind of made a mess of the health service such that it's now largely unaffordable for the vast majority of the population. So the idea that these people are suddenly going to drive a consumption boom, which drives the economy, is just absurd and ridiculous, and it can't and won't happen. So no amount of government intervention can override that one, and the intervention that has happened has made this problem worse rather than better. There is some good news, of course, in that the millennial generation is a monster, but these guys are on average too young to drive the economy. And we've got to wait until somewhere between 2020 and 2023 before the millennial generation will do all the right positive things to drive the economy. And we've got to get to there from where we are now, and that's when these artificial interventions are going to have to be unwound. But you're absolutely right that in the short term, and it's not just America doing it, I mean, but Europe's doing it, Japan's doing it, many other central bankers are doing this same policy. They've been a failure, they aren't working, and they're causing massive mispricing of asset classes all around the world. And that's where my gloom and bearishness comes from.
So to summarize, it sounds like the message is to be informed by the long period cycles, and for now, in this current central bank intervention environment that we live in, maybe de-emphasize the shorter term cycles that are more easily interfered with. If we take those sort of rules and start to apply this to markets, let's move on now to the U.S. dollar, because that's something that a lot of guests that we've had on the program, and my own view has been that perhaps the U.S. dollar is getting ready to break out to the upside. And I think you have an opposite view. So please explain your views on the dollar, what informs them, and what do you see coming?
Well, against something like sterling, the dollar has broken out to the upside. But what's really happening is it's the pound that's going down. On the chart, the DXY, or the dollar trade weighted, which is probably more important to follow than any individual cross rate, it's been in a sideways trading range of roughly 92 to 100 for 2 years now. And in the early part, I mean 2 years ago, until about 1 year ago, most of the fluctuations within that range took place above the various moving averages which technical analysis use. More recently, the fluctuations have taken place below the moving averages that technicians use. Now, that's not good. If this was something other than the dollar trade weighted, you'd imply being below the moving averages as a negative signal. However, there is no breakdown unless the DXY goes under 92. And rather perversely, I think, because we're in the new normal now, in the old normal, if the currency goes down, that makes U.S. exports much more competitive, would be good for the earnings per share of those companies. So it would be a bullish thing, just as we've proved recently since Brexit, the pound has fallen. So our biggest companies, Shell, BP, Jaxo, with HSBC, with loads of overseas earnings, have gone up in price. But what's happened in this new normal is the world has been herded into the dollar as the so-called the safe haven currency. And if you now then turn it to trash in their hands, you cause panic, not competitiveness. So you're absolutely right. If we were on an upward breakout and it went to, let's say, 103 or 4 or more, then that would be people going into the dollar. There would be trade-offs, of course. The reverse of what I've said is U.S. exports would be less competitive, but people that had panicked into the dollar would be very pleased with what they've done. But rerun that. It's people panicking out of everything else to drive the dollar up like that. But all of our work suggests that because of those demographic reasons, there is no scope for the U.S. economy to suddenly go into some great boom ahead. That can't happen until the millennial generation are quite a bit older. So the reason why the dollar would break up is to hedge the fact that everything else in the world economy would be breaking down. And that would be the overriding thing. It would actually be bad news if the dollar went rocketing up. In fact, you could argue that any form of destability, the dollar going strongly above 100 or strongly below 92, either one would be bearish because they would enter yet more uncertainty into the world than we've currently got. And we have got plenty of uncertainty right now.
Okay, let's move on to the equity market. You know, there are so many famous people, very, very successful people, whether it be Carl Icahn or George Soros or Stan Druckenmiller, Ray Dalio recently saying the credit cycle was over. And I know from a technician's standpoint, if we look at the trend line that started February 11th, I think it was, and then June 27th, something like that, we're starting to see a breakdown below that uptrend. A lot of technicians that I've heard have said we've got to stay above 21.25 or else it's a very bearish signal. As I'm speaking to you on Thursday morning, we're looking at about 21.27, so we're right on the hairy edge of that. Are we close to what could be considered a technical breakdown and a sell signal in equity markets here?
Almost all markets in the world are already in a bear market and have been for over a year. The fact that the S&P is where it is due partly to the interventions we've been discussing and also due to 5 to 8 stocks in the index with names like Alphabet, Apple, Amazon, Facebook. These are giant market cap stocks which didn't exist in the old normal, and they typically are on incredibly high earnings multiples. I think Amazon's at about 350 times earnings now, but they've definitely been holding the index up. If you say, well, let's take them out and look at the ones that have always been the backbone of America, we're talking Walmart, General Electric, IBM, it's quite obvious we're in a bear market. And what we've had is a bear market rally. Typically, that bear market rally is over, is as near over as makes no difference right now. And another thing that follows from this, if Fed intervention and central bank intervention doesn't allow us to have a nice, steady bear market to reset prices to fair value from being expensive, then what you've actually done is increase the chances of there coming a flash crash. We've had a flash crash over here in sterling. It fell 8% in about 1 minute flat a week ago. And sterling isn't the only thing capable of flash crashing. I remember very well 1987. Back then, world markets were actually in a bull market. And yet, for what seemed at the time like no apparent reason, you came in one day and found that I seem to have lost 20%. How did that happen? And of course, it was all over fairly quickly. 3 months later, it was quite hard to remember what had actually happened. But nonetheless, it was as scary as hell at the time, and a lot of money got lost. I think we are very vulnerable for those stocks and markets which are expensive to come down to something like fair value. Taking the CAPE PE ratio on the US market, that would involve a fall of 50%. For it to be cheap, by its own historic yardsticks, the fall would be 75%. Well, that would go straight into the history books and indeed the annals of legend, along with 1929, wouldn't it? The market to fall that amount. Nobody's saying anything's going to go wrong with the business of Google or Facebook, but if the PE ratio comes down to what by U.S. standards has been deemed fair value, a 50% decline is the absolute minimum that's needed to do that.
And what would you be watching as far as signals to tell you that that move is beginning? Is there a particular price level or other signal in the market that you can watch for that would tell you that that big move is on?
The other thing, well, if you go below the 200-day moving average, I think most algorithms will start shorting like crazy. plenty of individual hedge fund managers have put shorts on individually selected stocks that look a bit ridiculous to them. But psychologically, what's happening is the public aren't really buying the market and haven't been for ages. The baby boomers tend to be taking money out of their mutual fund and other savings plans because they need the money now to live on and, as they say, trying to scale down their living expenses and cope with existing in this new normal. The very fact that the two candidates for the presidential election are who they are. And over here, we've had some pretty weird voting things, quite unprecedented. These are the sort of social signs that the public in our countries are not happy with what they've been getting. And they want something different. And for 95% of all Americans, they're not the ones who are all well off. It's the top 1 to 2% who've been doing terribly well with the stock market. The average guy has absolutely not been doing that well. And he's become aware of that. Somebody else seems to be screwing me, if I can put it like that. And they're not unhappy with it. And you're getting social unrest. And when you compare the social unrest we're getting in lots of places now to previous periods in history, it's always at that time been followed by a recession, occasionally by a depression, and on rare occasions by war. And, of course, the war won't be in UK or in the USA, but we're very close to war elsewhere in the world, and that's deeply unsettling, making us negative.
Let's move on to Treasury yields. You know, we've heard so many different views on this. Since 2000, Treasuries have outperformed equity markets dramatically in terms of capital appreciation if you're buying duration risk. You know, we've heard my friend Raul Paul at Real Vision says, if anything, this backup in rates is a buying opportunity. We're headed to sub 1% yields on the 10-year. Jeff Gundlach on the other side, very famous bond manager, has used almost the same argument but come to the opposite conclusion, saying, hey, guys, it's a 35-year bull market in bonds. It's coming to an end. You know, it's time to start betting in the other direction. Where do you see this resolving?
Well, you're absolutely right. If you simply plot the yield on the 10-year Treasury, you're going to see the Kondratiev wave mapped out before you, basically. Ever since 1946, end of the war, over here, gilts in England and Treasury bonds in America, in real purchasing power went down and down and down, and something called the cult of the equity is what went up and up and up. And then about 30 years ago, it flipped over the other way. We've been coming down the other side of that Kondratiev wave. And you're right, when you get to be zero, you can't go an awful lot lower than that. And in real terms, of course, we're at zero now. We're actually negative right now. I do believe that the Bank of England and the US Fed do not want to actually have a nominal rate that is negative in their countries. But plenty of other countries, I mean, a third of government bonds around the rest of the world are already negative. I mean, in Switzerland, they've issued a 50-year bond where you're going to get slightly thrashed every year, and people are queuing up for that. Now, one is asked, why would people do that? Are they all sadomasochists? And the answer is, the guarantee that you'll get quite a lot of your money back sounds quite good if you were worried you might get none of it back because you speculated in the wrong asset class. So, but it's not sustainable. And many people, including Bill Gross, have tried to call the end of the great bond bull market before. I myself stuck my neck out in 2003 thinking this is it. And for about 4 years, we looked as though we'd nailed it. But we were too early. It was just a plateau, and we've come lower again. So I think we will get it so that in real terms, we will be well into negative territory, even if in nominal terms, we only go close to zero. And on my work, on my cycle work, the turning point, it looks like being roughly this time next year. So late 2017 always looked like it might be the lowest low in the cycle, and then it will be back into real assets, and you'll be buying cheap equities then. But from 27 times earnings on a Cape, that's not U.S. equities. They're not the cheap ones. They need to come down between then and now to be cheap and get bought. The cheap equities are in Asia, basically. They're in places like India with great demographics, cheap markets. And even though India is expensive by its own historic yardsticks, it's half the price of American equities. So, and it's got everything going for it. So, I mean, this is, you're going to, well, I know from talking to U.S. equity fund managers, they're looking to this sort of part of Asia to make money and taking it away from good companies which are too highly rated in their own home market.
So, to summarize, it sounds like you think about 1 year from now is where this 35-plus year bull market in bonds eventually tops out, and we see the low in yields, high in price, and the big secular trend is still about a year away from turning, according to the cycle work that you're doing.
That is the low in the commodity market should be at that stage as well. My work is quite clear that the final low for commodities is not yet in place. Of course, the fact that oil has come up from $26 to $52, suddenly you hear a whole lot of people telling you it's going to 80, whereas my work was absolutely adamant, no, it's not going to 80, it's coming back down again, and we'll keep falling until to make that final low in about a year's time.
So you don't think that 26 was the final low for oil? You think there's still a lower low coming?
I think you're going to at least have a very close retest of that low. I mean, 30 would be fine for me as a sort of ballpark. But the notion that it's about to go to 80 and all those crackers will suddenly get rich again, I don't buy that one little bit. And even when the various Arab states agree with each other, let's try and get a sort of monopoly going here again, Russia's on our side, that's not going to work either. Historically, these guys cheat on each other like crazy. And besides which, they need the money. They're going to keep pumping. Only if Saudi agrees totally to be the swing producer and take the hit all by itself will you get the price steadying up. I think you'll find it fluctuates and goes down. And only if there were a war flare-up, a real war in the Middle East, well, that could suddenly mean we can't get any gasoline or whatever, and then I could be wrong. But we wouldn't like the world we were in if we were wrong for that reason.
Okay, so tying all of this together, in terms of the developed market secular outlook, you said our last major secular trend change was in 2000, and you feel that what we've been through is a bear market rally, basically.
Yeah.
I assume then that your expectation is markets roll back over. The secular bear market has not played out yet. How long do you think we've got before we get to? Is it that same late 2017, or is the equity low at a different time than the commodity low?
I think basically after the great fall, you're going to have a base building period. Now, if I'm right that we get down there with something approaching a flash crash, then it may well be that the low made in October 2017 is actually the lowest low. But then the market doesn't go straight bouncing up like a rubber ball into a new bull market. It spends a long time going sideways in a rather narrow and rather boring trading range, making a base for a later roaring bull market. But the roaring bull market doesn't look as though it's really going to get going until after 2020. So there'll be a sort of flat period down there. The type of equities that I think would be picking up would be those related to the commodity cycle, which, of course, are already pretty beaten up, and they'll be even a bit more beaten up by the time. And so they would count as real assets. And the currencies that go with that, like the Canadian dollar or the Aussie dollar, I would expect them to play into that cycle as well. So they may be the first type of equities to really look like they're in a bull market. But the more industrial sector would take that long time to make a base before they get going again.
Now, if we're talking about a very pronounced down move in developed markets, as you're describing, I note what seems to me like kind of a conundrum. On one hand, you've already described a very bullish argument for China and India having completely different fundamentals. But I would also think that a lot of money in China and India is Western money. And if there is a huge equity sell-off in the West, people are going to be selling everything, including China and India. So I would think there would be downward pressure there. What do you see happening for emerging markets as this developed market story plays out?
No, you're absolutely right that when you suddenly find you need money, you sell whatever you can sell. And that's frequently the things that you actually like most and want to hold on to. And that certainly, I think, would bring China up again. China also has a monstrous debt bubble. The fact that its economy seems to be growing at 6.7% at the moment, which is a jolly good number, is done because of the enormous sums of credit which are being pumped out. And that's got to be deflated. Obviously, to the extent that foreigners are in the Indian market as well, they would probably take a bit out and the index would come off. But the good thing about India is it doesn't import or export very much of anything to anybody. It needs to buy some oil, so the low price of oil is a bonus for it. But it can grow itself from a $2 trillion economy to a $5 or $6 trillion economy without importing or exporting much. It's all about putting in very basic infrastructure, water pipes and drainage pipes into the villages where most Indians actually live. And then between them, building more roads, extending the already enormous railway system and making it more efficient. But we're not talking anything like bullet trains as in China. We're talking about old-fashioned trains that run more efficiently. And then finally, the electrical generation system, which is, straight out of a Dickensian Victorian novel, that needs to be modernized. But none of this is rocket science. It's all basic common sense infrastructure development. Nothing new needs to be invented. And yet you can double or treble the size of this economy. So to me, if there was a serious wobble, like, say, a 20% setback in the Indian market, I think you'd find a lot of people saying, I'm willing to look ahead and buy the hell out of this one. It's one of the few places politically stable relative to many of its neighbors. They speak English. I understand where they're coming from. And the Modi regime is absolutely what this country needed. And he's arrived at the right time to drive it forward. So the biggest risk would be Modi must stay alive. As long as he stays alive, I think I could see a secular uptrend in India running at least a decade from now. And with the economy compounding at 10% per annum or even a little more.
Okay, and let's move on to gold, because I could make either argument for gold. On one hand, if everything else is going down, it's a flight to safety. On the other hand, sometimes we see, as we did in 2008, that gold sells off with everything else. So as you see this big equity sell-off in developed markets, what happens to gold?
Yeah, well, in most currencies other than the U.S. dollar, it's been in a roaring bull market for a long time now. Even in the dollar terms, it's actually in a pretty good bull market at the moment as well. But there was a time when it fell back from the old all-time high of 1950 to roughly 1100. Obviously, in dollar terms, for 3 to 4 years, it wasn't a great investment. And, of course, the mining companies in this sector were being thrashed, absolutely thrown away and trashed, and it was hardly worth operating the mines. Now, even in dollar terms, it's in a bull market. But its first leg up was from roughly 1100 to 1380. And the chart said between 1380 and 1400 there was very substantial overhead resistance. And you were going to see some profit taking and a consolidation. And my prediction was it would come back to between 1200 and 1250. Well, we've recently been about 1250. We're tiny. We may yet get into that range. But once it resumes the uptrend, which I'm pretty sure it will do, even in dollar terms, it will not only go through 1400, and then there's nothing much to stop it to going back towards the old all-time high of 1950. Only if it goes through 1950 will all of those predictions with a couple more zeros added on the end come right. I'm not a gold bug as such, but I'm certainly long of it myself at the moment, and expect it to go up, certainly within the next year, to be above 1,400 on its way to 1,900. Of course, if it were to go past the all-time high, you wouldn't want to be in U.S. dollars there. I think what would have happened is we would have had some event, possibly economic, possibly warlike, which has scared everybody witless, and they didn't even want to hold the U.S. dollar. And they would be stuffing things into their mattress, and gold coins would be high on that list. Longer term and more rationally, we are moving from an era, and if you think about history, England used to dominate. Then we've had a long period with America dominating, which it still does. But we're quite obviously moving into a future where first China and then later India, mainly with Asia anyway, are going to be the largest economies with the most people on it, and we better get used to this. And in their culture, both of those two cultures, gold is not a commodity. Gold is money. It's real money. And paper money, they don't trust an inch, basically. China is already the largest single miner of gold on the planet, bigger than South Africa. It's building up its reserves, and it's quite good at only buying when the price suits them rather than just continuously all the time. And the Indians, as they become wealthier, will continue to buy gold, not just for the festival of Diwali or for weddings, but in big size, because it's deep in their genes. They regard this as proper money. If it were just a commodity or a pet rock, it's about 40% too high right now. It's managed to detach itself from the CRB and the other commodity indices. It's not behaving like a commodity at the moment. It's behaving like money, and money that the Asian part of the world loves better than it loves any fiat currency. So going with that, I'm long. I think we're going to make a profit on it, not necessarily a super-duper-duper profit, because, as you mentioned earlier, when people are really worried, they'll need to raise liquidity from whatever they can raise it on. And there may later come a day in a bear market for other assets. Actually, it's only the gold that they can turn into liquidity again.
Now, the whole story that you've told us based on your cycles work is looking kind of grim for developed markets, at least for the next little while. You said it really doesn't get better until the millennials get older, driving a generational cycle. So if we can find some good news in this story before we wrap up this interview, when does this eventually change? When does the next boom kick in, and what drives it?
Right, we shouldn't be too gloomy. The first thing is, none of my economic indicators at the moment are saying the world is going into a Great Depression. When we talk about what we do need to do is to get interest rates back up to a sustainable old normal, whereby, they're, as I said before, they're the rate of inflation plus however fast the economy is growing. And what we're actually, I think we're going to get is the economy is slowing down to a low positive rate of growth, but we call it a subpar rate of growth. The second thing is, and this goes back to Schumpeter, he invented an expression he called creative destruction, that new industries come along, and without exception, they always kill old industries. So the motor car killed the horse-drawn carriage. The cell phone killed telephones. And luckily for us, modern technology is queuing in the wings now. There are a lot of technologies, each one of which will produce new industries. We've got plenty of them in things like Facebook and Google. These are new industries. They don't employ millions of people. But I think we are on the cusp of the robotics age coming along. I mean, I can easily, not too far down the road, we'll talk at R2-D2 or C-3PO, and, you know, we'll all have staff, but then there'll be little tin men. They won't be humans. And we're having the driverless electric car. There's all of these new industries coming along. And when that kicks in with the millennial generation being really, really old enough to drive the economy, I think you'll have an unstoppable great boom ahead. And because so many of these inventions are Western world ideas, we may make them somewhere else, but we invent them here, we're definitely going to have our share of the action here. And you can already see some of these coming. There'll be others, I think, new sources of power. It's not just lithium batteries replacing old batteries. Solar panels are much, much more efficient now and cost-effective than they ever used to be. So whole new industries are coming along which will need to be built. And when you look at the demographics, the millennials will probably start driving the economy from 2020, when the eldest of them, you know, get their proper job and maybe get married and start buying starter homes. However, unlike earlier generations of students, the millennials typically graduate with $80,000 to $90,000 of student loan debt. And if they buy a car on top of that, they're over $100,000 in debt. So it'll take their lift off a little while to get some real momentum. But from 2023 onwards, it'll be unstoppable. I just think it'll go boom. And many of the industries that will be driving that, we haven't even anticipated them yet. They'll just like, you think how fast the cell phone went from being a little toy made by a company called Nokia to all of a sudden it isn't made by them, it's made by a whole bunch of other people, and everyone on the planet's got one. It'll happen really, really fast and be very powerful and very positive, and the standard of living across the world will go up a long way. But we've got to get to that starting point. But we can see the seeds of its creation already there. They're in the ground and they're being watered to some extent.
Okay, so given all of these views, where does that leave you in terms of asset allocation? It sounds like you like treasuries and precious metals. Do you have any equity exposure here? Do you keep it in emerging markets? Or how do you build a portfolio with these views informed by your cycles work?
Yeah, what we you've got Katina, as they say. There is no alternative. You do have to own something. You can't, however much you'd like, just say, okay, liquidate the portfolio. Although some of the very famous people you mentioned have got up to a third of their assets in cash. For the coming 12 months, I think we want to take as little risk as possible. And this leads to what we call a barbell strategy. In the middle of the bar, where all the other assets are, we just don't want to own them. And to some extent, that will include property as well. If you don't have to own half a dozen houses, don't. Just own the one you actually live in and get rid of the spare ones. This is global. It's not just the US or European thing. It would apply globally. But you do need to own, because you want some sort of security, highest quality government bonds, which is UK gilts and US treasuries, because there, for all the minimal yield, you are actually guaranteed, as far as a guarantee can be given, to get most of your money back in a year's time or whenever you want it. And then at the other end, although we're very far hard to make forecasts, there are certain business franchises which, firstly, are bigger than most of the countries on the planet, and they're pretty secure, and they're paying dividends. And even if they cut the dividend a bit, the dividend stream that they're going to convert into a present value looks as though it's better than a treasury or a gilt. In fact, in the old normal, decades at a time, no more than 5% of stocks ever yielded more than a long-dated government bond. As of now, in the new normal, 60% of stocks yield more than a government bond. This is clearly ridiculous, of course, because equities aren't as good as government bonds. They're inherently riskier. But on the finest quality businesses, when you simply can't live without the good or service that the business provides, if they look like paying a decent, sustainable dividend, owning some of them for an income is the way to go. And then for the coming year, you do want a cushion of liquidity. Some of it might be in gold, but some of it in liquid assets, and the US dollar is fine by me, so that you'll be able to buy some bargains when this reset has taken place, which I'm pretty sure is going to come, and then you'll be able to pick up some good stocks. Of course, if you were a super sophisticated risk-taking investor, you'd actually go short of some things in the meanwhile. But that's pretty dangerous for the public to do. And as that excellent book and film did make clear when it came out, The Big Short, even if you were correct to be a bear and put your short on, you have to be a bit early, and you die a thousand deaths and nearly go bust before you get the payout, even if you were a successful bear. So for the average person, don't do the shorting. But I'm sure some of the big hedge funds will do shorting of lots of things which they can see just going down. And from 27 times earnings, the index can fall quite a long way before those very same stocks just appear to be fair value or cheap.
Okay, finally, we ask all of our guests not to describe their own personal views, but just to comment objectively. Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump as president, either of those outcomes, what do you think the immediate impacts on markets would be?
I think whoever wins is going to preside over a cooling economy, if not a recession, or with a high probability that it will turn into at least a minor recession. And they will not enjoy their first 2 years in office, whoever it is. And the voting, however extraordinary it seems, voting around the world, the public of the planet, seem to be voting against elite politicians screwing things up, yet telling you what you've got to do. And so against all the logical odds, that actually puts the Donald in quite a good position. Although I have no personal thing against Hillary, who must, on paper at least, be the most highly qualified person ever stood to be president.
Well, unfortunately, Robin, we're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time, but I'm sure that a number of our listeners would like to follow your work. You did an excellent interview on Real Vision Television recently, which I would highly encourage for our Real Vision subscribers. For people who are not on Real Vision, where can they follow your work?
At the Global Investment Roadmap. www.globalinvestmentroadmap.com.
www.globalinvestmentroadmap.com. Thanks so much. It's been a fantastic interview, Robin. Aaron Chen and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Wow, Eric, great interview. And, you know, the first question I had is about Robin's views on how millennials and technology will save developed markets from secular decline. Now, maybe just to play devil's advocate, but personally, I know tons of people in my generation who are saddled with student debt. And when I think about the automation risks posed by robotics and the utter non-alignment between education and the skills required, I mean, I'd like to believe that our generation will ride in on our robotic horses to drive the Western economies forward. But honestly, with the insurmountable government debt and Western politicians seemingly hurtling us towards armed conflict, I mean, it appears to me that our generation has a Herculean effort or task ahead, and I'm not convinced we'll overcome. What do you think?
Well, I'm glad that you're accepting responsibility that it's all your generation's fault. but kidding aside, I think that the way I look at this is the millennial generation, I think, has yet to find its contribution to society. And to be sure, millennials have contributed a lot of really cool stuff. We've got social networking, Facebook. This was all invented by millennials. It's very much the millennial generation that has made it successful. But, you know, as cool as that stuff is, and I think it's really cool. I love Twitter. It's not really helping the country be more competitive. Whereas if you look at previous generations, you know, the IT revolution, computerization of business made those businesses more profitable and more competitive. It made the country more productive. I think that millennial contribution to technology so far has made millennials more connected to each other by social networking, which is really cool. But as far as what's the advancement that's going to economically advance society, other than just Facebook stock going to the roof, I'm not sure that it's been there yet. And I don't think that means that millennials are slackers that aren't going to do anything. I think the millennial generation hasn't found what needs to be engineered or what needs to be created in order to make that next advance. So when Robin says that, after 2023 or so, the timing is about right for the millennial-driven boom to happen, well, most booms happen when, a new generation invents something the old guys didn't understand. And maybe that's about to happen in the next few years. We'll see.
Yeah, something makes me think that Facebook 2.0 just isn't going to cut it. Well, I want to move on to the U.S. dollar. And Robin's point about how in this new normal, where investors have piled into the U.S. dollar's safe haven, a decided breakdown out of this 20-month trading range could trigger a panic sell-off in dollar-denominated assets. Now, Eric, is this finally the demise of the world's reserve currency? Or will the panic reflexively lead people back into U.S. dollars? I mean, if we get the equity sell-off or flash crash that Robin described, the default reaction is to pile into treasuries and U.S. dollars. So in the end, what breaks this reaction function?
I think that it's very much a reaction function back into U.S. dollar-denominated assets, particularly U.S. treasuries. I think that will continue to be the safety trade. And the reason is simply there is no alternative. Even though Russia and China would love to change the game and say that the U.S. dollar is not going to be the world's reserve currency, you got to remember that trade settlement and central bank reserve assets are two very different things. You may see some success of China and Russia changing the way that the U.S. dollar is used for trade settlement. And that will change things because it will mean that there will be less demand internationally for dollars, and it will change the dynamics slightly. But at the end of the day, what are central banks going to denominate their reserve assets in? The savings account or the piggy bank for a country, so to speak, are the central bank reserve assets. Those are going to be in U.S. treasuries because there is no bond market in the world that is deep and liquid enough to absorb central bank-sized capital flows other than the U.S. Treasury market. Now, I do think that someday there will be, because there's a lot of people in the world that are increasingly ticked off with the U.S. dollar's hegemony over the global financial system. But so far, they haven't created a viable alternative. And until they do, that safety trade, the panic trade, is going to be back into U.S. Treasuries.
Well, Eric, speaking of being ticked off with U.S. hegemony and, before we run out of time, I wanted to get your take on something that was mentioned quite a bit in the last presidential debate, and that's war. My word counter broke after the nth mention of Putin, Mosul, Iran, and Syria, but it appears to me that we're inching ever closer to a global conflict. So, following the same rules we've had with our guests of leaving out their personal opinions, I want to get your take on what either candidate would mean for world peace or war, which seems more likely now.
I'm very concerned about it. People accuse me of being a conspiracy theorist or something. I really think if you look at history and what some of our most informed guests have said, whether it was Jim Rogers on our very first show, I said, don't you think that there's a possibility that these circumstances lead to war? And Jim Rogers said, no, it's not a possibility. Every single time in recorded history that we've had the kind of financial circumstances that we have now, it's always led to war 100% of the time. The question is how long it takes and where it happens. I think that it is a very different scenario of where the risks are. Hillary Clinton clearly wants to pick a fight with Russia, and I'm scared to death if Hillary is elected that we will see an escalation of tension between the U.S. and Russia. It will start with the proxy war stuff, but eventually, even though it's happening in some third-party country like Syria, once U.S. forces kill Russian soldiers or Russian forces kill U.S. soldiers directly, everything escalates dramatically, and it could get really, really ugly really quickly. And I think that we are at as high of a risk now as any time during the Cold War. Now, it might sound like I'm about to turn, big super Trump fan, and I'm not. I think Trump is a loose cannon. He's more likely to first cause trouble with Mexico and then potentially, I think, get into initially a trade war that could escalate to a shooting war with China. So I think that it's a different mechanism of which countries Hillary or Donald would pick a fight with, but they both seem to me to be anything but pacifists, and I'm very concerned about the future of the world under either outcome.
So it's either the dragon or the bear. Sounds like good options. Well, Eric, that's all the time we've got. Anything you'd like to add?
Our regular listeners know the drill. It is so helpful to us. If folks, tell everybody you can about Macro Voices. Forward your research roundup emails to your colleagues and friends. The more people that know about the show, and particularly the more registered users we have at macrovoices.com, that statistic of how many registered users and how many accredited investor registered users we have is what Aaron uses to recruit the very best guests. And we've got a fantastic one coming up for next week. I'll leave that as a surprise for now. But the more that you help us, the more that we can help you by bringing you better guests. Go to macrovoices.com, register your free account. That gets you the benefit of a research roundup email subscription every single week. And Aaron, why don't we tell them what's in this week's research roundup?
Right, Eric. We've got the latest from Kyle Bass, who spoke at the Vanity Fair New Establishment Summit in San Francisco, wherein he argues that the Chinese will need to perform a mammoth banking recap for the recklessly built financial system in the not-too-distant future. Next, you'll definitely want to check out the latest piece from Ambrose Evans-Pritchard over at The Telegraph, where he writes about Otmar Issing's recent statement to the journal Central Banking about how the euro is a house of cards waiting to collapse under its own weight of political incompetence and moral hazard. Oh, and just in case you didn't know, Professor Issing was the ECB's first chief economist and the founder of the Monetary Union, for which he is predicting ruin. So hat tip to Grant Williams for sharing that article. Now, finally, we've got the latest quarterly market commentary from Jeffrey Gundluck's Double Line Capital. Now, one interesting fact from the report was that, quote, in 19 out of the past 22 elections, and every election since 1984, the incumbent party has retained the White House if the S&P 500 index had appreciated over the prior 3 months. Now, for us, that magic number is 2181, so it'll be interesting to see if that's correct this time around. Well, you'll find all this and much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we've gotten, and continue to welcome your suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For our listeners who write or blog about global markets and would like to share that content with our pro-finance community, shoot us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag and we'll include it in our weekly distribution. If you haven't already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for the latest updates and interview releases. You can also follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend and myself at _AaronChen_. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chen. Chat with you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.